Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
This is Late Night Live with me, Norman Swan, on my best behaviour because the master himself's on the line from Dili, sitting on his bed of straw after about 10 days of self-denial. But we'll keep Philip waiting just a tad because I must tell you about what will be a memorable conversation with someone who's considered one of the world's most influential people in opera. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner for his music criticism, someone who specialises in reviving the reputations of forgotten authors, who was lionized as a filmmaker as a teenager and has done all this with Asperger's syndrome, or more likely he's done it because of it. And later we'll also delve a little into what some are saying is the hypocrisy and panic over the capital punishment row. But to Philip, whose blog I'd highly recommend to you, if only for his whinging about the hotels he's been staying in. What did you expect, Philip?
I've never known discomfort like this, Norman, but it's all in a good cause. It's been a fantastic 2 weeks, and I'm just overwhelmed by it. In fact, I'm almost speechless, but I suppose I'd better think of something to tell you.
You better. And we'll come back to the discomfort later. It looks as though you've been praying a lot since you left Sydney.
I've been to quite a few masses. This is 110% Catholic country. And I've seen the error of my ways, so I will come back to the program a very different fellow.
An animist? You've been to one animist service?
Yes, we did a bit of animism, but mainly Catholicism. And, of course, you know, even rubbed noses with a few people who were not at great distance from Marxism. Can I just tell you one image which sort of sums up what we've been doing and what we've been going through? We went to a remote coastal village, and we've done 1,400 kilometres, I think, which sounds nothing in Australian terms, but here is a monumental journey because the roads are so appalling and you drive at perhaps, 5 kilometres an hour. And we arrive in this village, which was wiped out very, very recently in a very nasty squabble. The whole place burnt to the ground. And I'm talking to these young people who were intense, angry to the point of trembling, as they tried to tell me the story of this atrocity perpetrated on them. And Norman, out of the crowd, very slowly and majestically, walked a very small, very old woman, totally implacable. And she just stood there, demanding to be interviewed, and that she didn't need to be interpreted. Well, she was interpreted, but it was almost redundant. She stood there and looked at me fiercely, not a hint of a smile, whereas everyone around us was smiling as Timorese do. And she talked about the Portuguese era, she talked about the Japanese, she talked about the endless agonies they'd had with the Indonesians, or certainly with the military. And then she talked about what had just happened. She talked about the way her own people had turned on themselves. And that, she says, that's the worst. And that's the sort of the message we've got here, that the most recent troubles have been the most traumatising of all that the Timorese have gone through. But they are through it, I think. And I think they're going to make a go of it.
You think so?
I came up here very pessimistic, thinking that failed state status was looming. But you leave the place convinced that they've paid such a price for this, Norman. I can't think of any other nation that's really, where almost the entire population have paid such a price. And they'll make it work.
You spoke.
They're intensely. Sorry.
You spoke to one of the people who could stop it happening, Mario Alcatiria. What was your impression of him?
Well, he's very fierce. He's like an eagle. He stares at you with his eagle eyes and his eagle nose, his eagle beak. But after a while, he started to relax, and we finished up having a very amiable and often quite amusing chat. And I get the feeling that some of this is theatrical. Here are these, in fact, I was putting it to the president today, that a lot of it's cockfighting. Cockfighting's the big sport up here. everyone, every other man is walking down the street stroking a chook because you know, this is the thing, the communal sport is chucking these roosters at each other. And I put it to the president that that's what goes on here, that there's a lot of cockfighting between the, you know, the big chooks, between the roosters. And there's, everyone knows in politics, today's rooster is tomorrow's feather duster. So a lot of the tension is between Alkatiri, Zunana, Porter, you know, and the almost fratricidal rages that break out between them. And yet, in private, and apart from away from the microphone, they then confess that they really all quite like each other, that they get on pretty well. And so I think at the end of the day, what unites them is orders of magnitude greater than what divides them.
And you met a 15-year-old hero of the resistance.
Well, was that how old he was? Yes, an extraordinary kid. We went to a ramshackle farmhouse in the middle of nowhere, very high up, where one of the heroes of the resistance had hidden from the Indonesians. And he'd hidden in a sort of a spider hole, really, rather like the thing that Saddam Hussein was found in, under a family altar. And so the altar, you know, covered in candles and Virgin Marys, and there was a few tiles which this little boy showed us how he'd lift out when he was five, I think, like five, and then he would take food down to this hero in the mountains, often within inches of the Indonesians. Well, sometimes the poor guy got so lonely down in his bunker, as they call it, that the little boy would go down and they'd play together in the darkness. This went on for quite some time. And at any moment, the fellow could have been discovered, would, of course, have been killed, but so would the little boy. Now, he's now 15. I asked him what his ambition was, and he said he wanted to lead the army. This is a pretty amazing sort of tradition to have, isn't it, at that sort of age?
Yeah. You talk about having hope, but you know, the history of many countries who've been through that sort of revolutionary zeal is that when the need for the revolution is over, there is fracture, there are the separate groupings. Do you get a strong sense of nationhood?
Well, the first week, as I said, all I could see was the fracture lines. All you could see were the problems. All you could see were the dividing issues. But you stick around longer, you talk more, you listen more. I think it's fair to say, in fact, Horta was saying tonight, that no media outfit has ever gone as far as we've gone or dug as deep or listened to as many. And you get a second wind, you get another sort of level of perception. And as I said, you realise that having sacrificed, having lost so much, they're not going to lose out to a couple of internecine squabbles. They were nasty, they frightened people, but already I think the healing's well advanced. And all the leaders, irrespective of their party affiliations or their ideological assertions, it seems to me, have that in common. They want to make it work. So even Alkatiri is nothing like as sort of as demonically possessed as he's painted. Generally, it's been a profoundly moving and very impressive.
It must have been pretty moving. It must have been pretty moving going to Balibo.
Yes, Balibo. There's this iconographic place to Australians where Greg and the boys died, the flag house. There's only a tiny fragment now of the flag that Greg painted on the building in the hope that it would protect them from the rampaging Indonesians when, of course, it became their shroud. It's now a thriving little community centre. It's full of sewing machines, for example, where the local women are learning sewing. There's a few other battered computers where the kids are learning to compute. There's a library, which I must say needs a few books before it's a full-fledged library, but there's a lot going on there. So that's another, if you like, another symbol of renewal in Timor. Tragedy, but out of tragedy, something positive coming.
And
they've paid a price for the vote. We're about to have an election. In Australia, you've got to be driven to vote. You will find you if you don't. Up here, people want to vote. They want to build a nation, and good luck to them.
And you imply in your blog that the Australians are not universally popular, and you uncovered a story, a story that hasn't really had much publicity, of the death of four East Timorese during an Australian army operation.
Yes, that's rather complicated to get into. I've also discussed that now with the brigadier who runs the troops up here. He's got 1,000 Australians and a few New Zealanders under his command. We'll be telling that story in some detail. Yes, there are a lot of signs being very rude about Australia. Sometimes they're linked to obscenities aimed at poor Shanana. But the very people who write those slogans up, when you sit down and talk to them, are immensely friendly to us as Australians. So a lot of the rage on the walls and every ruined building up here is a chance for graffitied anger, you know, for a remarkable sort of democratic dialogue. But it melts away. And I said to a Fretland woman who, on one level, seems to hate Shanana, I said, you have no idea how hurt he is about the sign saying Shanana's a traitor. And she said, he's hurt? That's good. That's good he's hurt. We're hurt. But look, we still love him. And in a way, some of that plays to Australians. There are very nasty slogans about us, but when you sit down with them, they're immensely friendly, generous, cordial, and they recognise that we've got a lot. We're so intermarried, Australia and Timor.
Philip, we're going to look forward to hearing all this when you come back, which is, you're leaving, what,
yes,
tomorrow?
Yes, a full day of travel tomorrow, and I'll be back on Monday. And Norman, have you remembered to feed my guinea pigs?
I have. Look, the black one's really pining for you, but, you know, I've told them that you're back soon.
Well, give it a cuddle. Give it a cuddle.
I will. I will.
See you, Norman.
Bye, Philip. Bye. Philip Adams talking to us from his straw bed in Dili. I thought I'd get on to what he's been eating, but I didn't want to depress him. Coming up next here on Late Night Live, Donald Rothwell and capital punishment. Of all the things to enter the election campaign, who'd have thought it would be capital punishment? And as Laura Tingle, our commentator on Late Night Live, wrote this morning in the Fin Review, the panicked overreaction of Kevin Rudd to the speech given by Shadow Foreign Minister Robert McClellan the other night when he was talking about opposition to the death penalty. And this is despite Kevin Rudd saying in an authorised biography earlier this year that one of his aspirations, should he become Prime Minister, was to rid the world of the death penalty. It seems now there's not much daylight between the Labour Party and the Coalition on capital punishment. And of course, the difficulty is over who might be acceptable to die and who not for the crimes they've committed. And I'm not talking about Western Australian politicians here. Professor Donald Rothwell is Professor of International Law at the College of Law at the Australian National University, and he's been involved in the issue for quite some time. In fact, Donald was legal advisor to Lex Lazary QC when he was trying to stop the execution of Australian Vietnamese Van Nguyen in Singapore. Welcome to Late Night Live, Donald.
Norman.
What's your take on the goings-on of the last day or two?
Well, look, Norman, I have to say that if you carefully look at the speech that Robert McClelland gave, much of what was reported in the media and much of what became the subject of media debate, certainly yesterday, is not in any way reflected in Robert McClelland's prepared and published speech. He didn't, for example, suggest that a Rudd government would be out there making strong representations for clemency for the Bali bombers, for example. Rather, what he was saying was that the Australian government needed to be consistent in its approach on this issue. So I'm a little perplexed as to how this matter blew up into the proportions that you've referred to. I suspect it might have been a little bit of muckraking by some in the media, perhaps.
But consistency is presumably the word that everything hangs upon here, isn't it?
Yes, certainly from where I stand as an international lawyer, if a country like Australia is going to have any credibility arguing the case for Australian citizens, for example, who are facing the prospect of capital punishment, it's absolutely essential that, the government be putting forward a consistent position. And I think that ultimately that position must be one based on human rights, respect for international human rights law, under which the death penalty is prohibited.
But that's my point when I'm talking about how everything hinges on consistency. If he's talking about consistent approach, then you are saying, in effect, there's no justification for capital punishment for Amrozi, for example.
Correct. But I think that one can make a distinction as to the way in which an Australian government would have a capacity to intervene on behalf of an Australian citizen faced with that prospect of a possible execution, where there would be no question mark about the legitimacy of such an intervention.
Okay, so argue the point with me then, because I think you're laudably trying to defend McClellan here, but nonetheless, we're talking about consistency. We're talking about the same week, the anniversary of the Bali bombing, and how do you argue it politically to the Australian public, many of whom are extremely angry and upset by the Bali bombing, and presumably many think that death's too good for these people? How do you argue that consistent case?
Well, as I said, I think you put it within the human rights framework. You point out that Australia, since the Second World War, has had a long and very proud history of support for international human rights. We're a party to all of the relevant international human rights conventions. We're a party to the second optional protocol to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which completely outlaws the death penalty. Australia, of course, has become what's called an abolitionist state. We abolished the death penalty in Australia in 1985. Therefore, both within our internal law and the international law that we're subject to, we have committed ourselves to opposing the death penalty. And accordingly, we should be making appropriate, I emphasise appropriate, representations where these issues arise on the international stage.
So now, what are the, just define appropriate, just give me an example.
I think that's where the distinction comes in, Norman, that in the case of an Australian citizen subject to the death penalty, the Australian government can legitimately exercise all of its diplomatic capacity in addition to exercising and pursuing a multiple range of legal options on behalf of an Australian citizen. With respect to other non-Australian citizens, Australia doesn't have that right. It doesn't have that right of representation. That doesn't mean to say that it can't make quiet representations if it would so choose to do so. But I think that many people within diplomatic circles would find it rather extraordinary that the Australian government would ultimately make a diplomatic representation on behalf of a non-Australian citizen facing the death penalty in any country around the world.
There are
other ways in which you can try to prosecute that type of more general argument that countries need to be moving towards the abolition of the death penalty.
So what is the strategy you think that would work if the objective is to spread abolition?
Well, I think there are two approaches. One is the multilateral approach, which ultimately is through the United Nations. And in fact, in New York today, in the United Nations General Assembly, there is a resolution going up before the General Assembly calling upon all of the UN member states to endorse a resolution agreeing to the abolition of the death penalty. So that's obviously an important step at the ultimate global level. But for a country like Australia, where our greatest influence at the bilateral and regional level, clearly is within this region, within Southeast Asia, within the Southwest Pacific. If Australia is seeking to work with a group of regional neighbours, well, working within this region is the most obvious approach to take at an international stage.
Do you think we overly focus on Asia, though, given that our closest ally, the United States, still is actively putting people on death row?
I think that we obviously focus on Asia because that's where most Australians seem to find themselves in trouble and where ultimately that's where many Australians have found themselves caught out by Asian countries having very tough drug trafficking laws. And so, of course, we've had the situation with Van Nguyen's case and execution in 2005. We've now, of course, got six members of the Bali Nine in that situation. We've had a number of Australians in recent years on death row in Vietnam. So
we have had some successes, though, haven't we?
Yes, we have. And diplomatic successes have certainly occurred in the case of at least two Australians in Vietnam in recent years. So I think it's inevitable that for a country like Australia, focusing the diplomatic initiative within the region where, as I said, Australians are travelling through the region or doing business within the region seem to be the most vulnerable to these types of laws makes good common sense.
Which is the country that you focus on most in the region?
Well, I think Indonesia perhaps at the moment is the most obvious one just because of the strength of the bilateral relationship between the two countries and quite obviously because six Australians are there on death row. But I think that if one is taking a regional approach, one can clearly not ignore the situation in China where various NGOs like Amnesty International are reporting that the rate of the imposition of the death penalty in China is far outstripping that of most of its other neighbours within the region, and certainly perhaps even outstripping that in the United States. So China is one of the most prominent practices of capital punishment at the moment, and given the Australian relationship with China, it would seem appropriate that China would certainly also be a target of some diplomatic action like this.
Do you think that our neighbours notice our inconsistencies when we argue strongly for Australians but think it's okay with the Bali bombers or it's okay to execute Saddam Hussein?
Well, look, I think they most certainly do, Norman. Not only through the wonders of the internet can basically the sort of media chat and discussion that's taking place within Australia be directly beamed into countries all around the world, but in addition, of course, these comments are clearly being noticed, and I think it's been striking how some of the lawyers representing the Bali Nine have pointedly referred to this inconsistency on behalf of the Australian government and how they fear that this is not necessarily helping their clients' cause in Indonesia at the moment.
Donald, thank you.
You're welcome, Norman.
That's Professor Donald Rothwell, who's Professor of International Law at the College of Law at the Australian National University in Canberra. And you're listening to Late Night Live on ABC Radio National with me, Norman Swan. Tim Page, welcome to ABC Radio National.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Would you like to back announce that piece of music, or am I putting you on the spot?
I know that piece rather well. That's Glenn Gould playing the Goldberg Variations.
Not many people would have recognized that, but how do you know it was Glenn Gould?
Glenn's, if you don't mind the analogy, his fingerprints are all over it.
Yes. I'm talking to Tim Page. Tim Page is the chief classical music critic of the Washington Post. He's been music critic for the Newsday, New York Times. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his music criticism, which has been called lucid and illuminating. A couple of years ago, Tim was chosen as one of the most 25 most influential people in the world of opera by the magazine Opera News. He's been artistic advisor and creative chair for the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. He revived the reputation of Dawn Powell, a satirical writer, an American satirical writer, and at least five of her novels have been published thanks to Tim's work. And the reason I wanted to interview you, Tim, is just because of that remarkable piece you wrote in The New Yorker a couple of weeks ago, where, in a sense, you came out as having Asperger's syndrome. Have you written about it before, or that was the first time?
No, I hadn't written about it before, and I'd actually, I really hadn't talked about it very much. I mean, people who were very close to me knew about it, and I'm sure some people who knew me, especially when I was a child, when I was least in control, at least suspected it. But I myself didn't know that I had it until I was 45 years old. And then a whole lot about my life, my strengths and my weaknesses became crystal clear.
And that was in the year 2000, you find out. So let's go inside your head and look out through your eyes.
Oh, gosh, that sounds awful. No, I'm joking.
Well, you imply in your article, that your piece, that it might be awful at times. But in a sense, how do you think you see the world compared to the people you know around you who don't have Asperger's?
Well, I think I'm fairly well adjusted now because I've been around for 52 years, and I know myself. I know how the rest of the world works, and So I think I'm pretty well adjusted, although there's no doubt in my mind that if you put me behind a counter in a store or something, and I had to deal with many, many different people in a row, I'd probably have a pretty much of a complete nervous meltdown. I have a extremely strong memory for facts, for data, for things that happened at certain points, and I'm very oblivious on other things. Now, I think everybody can say, I mean, everybody is different, but with Asperger's people, we have a tendency to really not understand a lot of what seems to make the rest of the world tick. As I said in the piece, in the years since it's become a cliche, I've always gotten these wonderful comments or compliments from friends who say, wow, you really know how to think outside the box. And the problem is I don't really recognize that the boxes are there. That's always a struggle for me. I mean, I just,
You certainly describe not being in the box as a child, and you use words like rage, contempt, out of control.
Yeah, well, that was very much the case. I mean, especially when I was a kid, I couldn't do a lot of the things that other kids could do, but I could do a lot of things that the other kids couldn't do. I had many, many weaknesses and a few real strengths. What would happen with this would be I'd just get very, very angry and very frustrated that I couldn't do things that everybody else
such
seemed
as?
To be able to. Well, any kind of sports, learning things that I wasn't, completely interested in, making friends on a level where I wasn't lecturing them and I wasn't, where we were just, two kids hanging out together. I wasn't capable of that, especially when I was a kid. I mean, I'm much more socially integrated now. But when I was a kid, what I really wanted to do was be alone and learn lots and lots of facts and study the things that I was good at. I really didn't care about what the rest of the world was about. I was kind of in my own world.
Did your parents worry about you?
Oh yeah, very definitely. Because it was very tough for them to realize that here was this kid who scored very well on some tests and who could have given you a
genius who flunked at primary school.
Exactly, who flunked constantly, who really flunked almost everything except for the stuff that I was really good at. And, you know, I was very awkward just talking with, say, one friend or you know, when I started to be interested in women, you know, talking to girls. But I was quite happy, say, being interviewed or giving a lecture or anything like that. I had no problem with that whatsoever. It was, you know, it was just as, I wasn't what they call neurotypical. I had I could have written a college-level dissertation on things that I was interested in, such as old recordings and silent films, but I couldn't pass seventh grade algebra. So,
you just talking about Glenn Gould, you were quite close to Glenn Gould, but interestingly,
yep,
it was a phone relationship.
It was almost entirely a phone relationship. We actually met in person only about a month before he died. But we spent a great deal of time on the phone. I sometimes suspect Glenn may have had some Asperger's qualities himself, and he found the phone much less distracting than in-person communication with people. I mean, the idea of Glenn as this sort of haunted, remote genius of the North has some truth to it, but only some. When you got him on the phone, he was one of the merriest and funniest and most childlike people, and I say that in a very good way, that I knew. I mean, there was just a joy in the world, and if he understood you and he felt that you were on his wavelength, and we took to each other immediately, he was just terrific company.
But did you take to him immediately because your minds worked the same way?
Well, that's certainly possible. You know, Glenn's dead 25 years. I wouldn't know for another 18 years after his death that there was such a thing as Asperger's syndrome. Now looking back at what I knew about Glenn, it wouldn't surprise me if he certainly had some of these qualities. I mean, when I first read the diagnosis, I felt that, oh my God, this is crazy. Somebody, you know, cooked up this condition just for me. I mean, I was just startled by how
much... You thought you were the only one in the world.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I felt that way. I felt absolutely like an alien. Because I couldn't figure out why my brain was able to take in so much, and yet I was so clueless, just so absolutely clueless on so many emotional things. And, you know, I still struggle with that. There's still times where, you know, I'm amazed by the things I simply just don't get. And then other things where I feel absolutely and completely comfortable, you know, and very happy.
People talk, people who've had childhoods for whatever reason where there's been a struggle often talk about a seminal moment or a person, something that's changed them. And often that's just symbolic, but you talk about a book on etiquette being one of those moments. But were there people as well? Just talk about the etiquette book for a minute, because that almost became your rule book for social interaction, wasn't it?
It did. It was really it told me and explained why people behave the way they did, which most people I think just get naturally. And I think sometimes if they start following etiquette, you know, very slavishly, they can seem affected, or they can seem processed or something like that. For me, it was actually just like this is why people are that way, and this is why you behave this way to make somebody more comfortable, and maybe you don't want to just lecture the whole time. And
taught you to listen.
It taught me to listen, and it sort of explained to me why people behave the way they did. I mean, it was almost like, I don't know, getting some kind of Rosetta Stone or something.
So did you take to this book the way you took to other things, where you completely absorbed it, memorized it, and it became almost algorithmically like a computer program? This is, you know, in this situation I do that, in that situation I do this.
Yeah, and I mean, and quite frankly, I still kind of live that way, not so much with Emily Post, but with other things that I've learned how to do. There are times where I feel, this is probably not entirely fair to myself, but there are times where I actually do feel programmed, where I feel that, okay, I go into this mode now, this I have down. But if I'm suddenly presented with a whole lot of new situations that I've never been in before, I become like that kid again, and I don't know really how to handle them. It's sometimes I won't understand a joke or some irony that somebody is using because, you know, I have a very sort of literalist brain. I mean, I think I have a pretty good sense of humor, but there are things now and then when I'm being put on, I don't really necessarily get it because it's very hard for me to read other people.
And what about those rages? Do they still happen?
Those are pretty much gone. They still happen every now and then. Usually when I'm tired, usually when I'm up late, usually when I feel sort of trapped in something. But they're pretty much gone. The one thing I would say to, if you've got any Aspie kids listening now or parents who are concerned about it, is that I have found, and at least anecdotal evidence suggests to me, that life gets better, that, you know, once you've found something that you can really throw all of that intensity and that knowledge, and you can throw your intensity into it and really work on something, I think Aspie people are, you know, sometimes the people who become really good professors or write unusual works of research because we have the ability to tune out everything else in the world.
Or make unusual movies.
Huh?
Or make unusual movies set on Mulholland Drive or things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of a predestined individualism. You can't do much about it. You're going to always have this somewhat slightly askew view of the world, but if you can find something that works for you, you can sometimes do, I think, great things. Anyway, that's what I would say. The problem with Asperger's syndrome is that two things tend to come along with it, and they are depression on the one hand and anxiety because, you know, life really is a challenge. I've certainly battled with both of those and continue to some extent. Once you've been around the block again and again and again and again, you do start to pick up some things. You learn that each disaster is not, you know, going to necessarily be fatal. On the other hand, you also learn that each triumph is not going to be permanent either.
How dark did it get? Because my understanding of Asperger's, and we haven't really defined it. I mean, we're really telling the story through your eyes, but it's a situation where interpersonal cues are missed, and understanding relationships, and it's part, although separate, to the autism spectrum. But you, it's said that with Asperger's that suicide is an issue. Has that ever occurred to you, of taking your own life?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, many, many times. Not really a great deal lately. Because you realize that there are people who love you, and you also realize that there just might come up another fascination one day. But yeah, I would say I was in a completely glum mood by the time I was in my teens, and I still battle somewhat with it.
The hope there is really what you say in your essay, which is that you grew up and grew into other preoccupations.
Yeah. That's basically it. You know, thank heavens for those preoccupations.
So tell us about this music preoccupation, because you talk, you might recognize my Scottish accent here, but you talk about a performer that my grandparents in Glasgow loved, Harry Lauder.
Well, I was fascinated by, I was very, very interested in these voices and these pictures, these moving pictures of people who were no longer active, but were somehow still speaking to me through these old recordings.
Because you were also obsessed with obituaries, weren't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, there was some kind of real terror of death that was there, and some kind of strange transfiguration in listening to these recordings and watching these silent films. And of course, Lauder sounded like music from outer space to me, but I was fascinated by it.
We should just explain to people who've never heard of Harry Lauder, he would come on effectively a Scottish vaudeville stage with a kilt on, knobbly knees, and sing Scottish songs
more than that, he'd always pretend to be absolutely drunk, and he'd hiccup the whole time, or most of the time. Some of his more serious songs, he didn't do that, but the hiccupping and the pretend intoxication was part of it.
I'm not so sure
too.
It was so pretend, Tim.
Well, I have a feeling it has to have been, but at least some of the time when he was actually performing. And, you know, let's remember, he went on till he was about 80. He gave more farewell tours than, I think it was Nellie Melba who was famous for giving a lot of farewell tours to go down under again for a moment. I just felt that these were somehow connections, and I understood them. And it was really like some kind of entree into a world that was gone, but a world that I felt very much a part of. There was a curious nostalgia for a time I never knew that I felt when I was a kid, and that I felt I would have been more comfortable in.
Take us to your first immersion in music and what that did to you, and what clicked.
Well, I can't really remember my first immersion because I was watching the records go around and around and around from when I was about two or so. As soon as I could get to my mother's record player and ruin her collection, which is what I basically did, I would just sort of watch them, and I'm sure I was fascinated by the movement. But I think the thing that really fascinated me was the music made sense to me in a way which most of what I was being taught and most of what I saw going on around me did not make sense to me. But a recording of an opera scene or a symphony, you know, somehow I had the sort of 2-, 3-, 4-year-old brain that took to it immediately and found something in it. And I think I was fascinated by the mechanics of the way that this spinning recording I was right at a point where 78s, 45s, and 33s were all readily available in my house. And I was just sort of amazed at the way it would open up this kind of new world. But it was more than just opening up a world. It was actually opening up a sense of understanding in me. I felt that I knew this music, that I could make sense of it.
You describe listening to Das Rheingold.
Oh, God, yes. Well, that was when I was about 12. And that was extraordinary for me because it was this static drone, the opening of Das Rheingold. I mean, we always think of Wagner as this man who did all this, you know, intensely chromatic music and, you know, helped pave the way for a lot of the modernism in the 20th century. But what was fascinating about Das Rheingold is you have a 3-minute chord, basically just a chord that grows and grows and grows. And I just thought it was the most extraordinary music in the world. And then very shortly after that, I discovered minimalism and became passionate about that music too.
Yes, you write about Steve Reich.
Yeah, Steve Reich, Phil Glass, and I did a lot of their radio music for the first time because they were both living in New York City and I was living in New York City, and I had this college radio station, and I said, "How'd you like to hear your music all over New York City?" And of course, for some strange reason, they thought that was a good idea. And so I got to know both of them, and I got to play a lot of their music and a lot of their premieres. And I've worked actively with both of them, and you know, continue to love a great deal of their music.
And it's minimalist music is something that's hard to get. What do you get from it?
Well, it certainly wasn't hard to get for me.
No.
I love the sort of steady state quality of it. I love the fact that there'd be one chord that just went on and on and on. And it felt almost like a sonic weather. It felt like it was music that I could actually dwell within. And I'd be fascinated by the slow and very subtle changes. You know, it's kind of droning. It's kind of like a mantra in some ways. And
so there's a resonance
for my
in your
particular
head.
Temperament, I just understood it immediately.
It was like a resonance in your head.
Absolutely. I mean, it was the soundtrack for my brain. you know, I have to mention something since I'm talking to Australia. You know, you have a marvelous doctor there named Tony Atwood, who's really has written most of the really crucial books about Asperger's syndrome
based
in the last
Queensland.
10 years, and who was very kind to me when I was first learning that I had this. And I sent him a bunch of emails, and he was extremely helpful, and he even read my piece. So I was quite grateful to him, and I wanted to acknowledge that publicly, because he, more than really anybody else right now, he's the guy who has helped explain it to a lot of people, including me.
He's based in Queensland.
Yeah.
Tell us about your relationships. You kind of allude to it in the article. You've been married, you've got three children, but just tell us about the things that, you know, for example, it must be hard when you have difficulty relating to people to actually have a sexual relationship with somebody.
In general, it has been, but, you know, that's not been something that has been, you know, completely lost to me. I mean, this is very personal stuff, and you know, I'm happy to talk about things generally, but there are other people involved here,
sure.
And so I don't want to go too deeply into it. I have been married twice, and in both cases, you know, things fell apart for different reasons.
Sure,
you know, terrific human beings, but you know, it's hard to deal with. You know, somebody who is, you know, it is hard. I mean, personal close relationships are a difficulty and have been and probably will remain. On the other hand, I have a lot of, you know, terrific and wonderful friends who have been incredibly loyal and who pretty much understand me and know all about me and really like me anyway. And
when you look around,
I'm very loyal to them, and they've been loyal to me.
And when you look around your friends, it's a normal spectrum of humanity, or are you attracted to people who look at the world in different ways?
You know, I don't go out of my way for varietism or anything like that. But it does. You know, the funny thing, do you know that film, The Shining?
Yep.
I've often felt that. If you remember the little boy and the elderly black man in The Shining, and there's one point where they have this talk, and the elderly man says something along the lines of, "We understand each other. We have The Shining." And I've often felt that with friends and people I met. I certainly felt that with Glenn Gould. I mean, you know, I was terrified to meet him because he was this, you know, famous, legendary guy. And we got on the phone and we were just laughing and cackling and bringing up obscure references and getting those references for hours.
Yes.
But I would say that, most of my friends are not many of them are Aspies. They're mainly just people I've known for a good long time, and people I've met more recently, and basically, I really like people. I sometimes don't feel that I communicate myself all that well to people, but I've learned that one of the best things to do with that is just to explain that, you know, there are occasionally some issues here, but I think people recognize that I'm quote-unquote eccentric pretty much from the start, and then they decide whether they like that eccentricity, whether it's something that they can respond to or something that they can't really respond to.
Tell me about Don Powell, which is this author that some people say that Dorothy Parker pinched Don Powell's witticisms and claimed them as her own.
Well, I don't think she did, but I do think that Don Powell certainly, I mean, we remember Dorothy Parker for some poems and some witticisms. And Don Powell, on the other hand, without the public relations machine that accompanied the whole Algonquin Roundtable, turned out book after book after book. I mean, she wrote 15 novels. She wrote hundreds of short stories. She wrote 10 plays. She wrote magnificent diaries. I just read about her, and I found her very interesting, and I started, I just became fascinated by her, and I came to be friendly with the with her family, and we actually ended up sort of effecting a palace revolution where we took over her estate from the woman who had been her executor, and we started releasing all of her books, and we've reissued 12 of her novels. The last three should not be released, in my opinion. She hated them, and I think we should allow her a few little mistakes.
And the novels that largely due to you have been re-released, how have they gone?
They've gone pretty well. You know, she's a special taste. She's very funny. In her time, people thought she was very, very bleak and sardonic and kind of brutal sometimes. Today we find that humor much more gentle and insightful than a lot of the critics who reviewed her back then did. She's also very interesting in that she chronicles Greenwich Village life, and she does it unsentimentally. For instance, she has lots of gay characters in her books, which was unusual for books written in the 30s and 40s. And what's even more interesting is that she doesn't turn these books into, you know, pleas for compassion or case studies of, you know, sexual abnormalities or anything like that, which was the way gay people were mainly treated in books back then. What she does is she just treats them as more people at the party, and she draws them pretty, you know, much as they are. I think it's one of the reasons she has a very large gay following.
And just finally, Tim Page.
Yeah.
When you think of the future, what do you see in front of you?
Well, I mean, there's some project I'm working on. I'm going to turn the New Yorker piece into a book. I'm going to be teaching arts criticism at the University of Southern California next year, which is something
Great.
I'm really looking forward to. On a personal level, I see a lot of struggle. I see a lot of continued anxiety and continued confusion about certain things. I also see some projects that will come along that I don't even know about right now that I'll be able to move in and do them and do them very well. And I see some really, really happy times. And I hope that's not just, you know, rose-colored glasses. But,
well, now that we've met, we'll follow up on those projects, Tim.
Well, I hope so, and thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. Tim Page, who's the chief classical music critic of Washington Post in 1995. If you want to follow up that essay that he wrote for The New Yorker, it was in the August 20th edition of The New Yorker. On our next Late Night Live, we'll be talking to Moises Naim, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine, who's been looking into the illicit trade that's been taking hold of our globalised world, plus Simon Nasht on his movie about Errol Flynn. Let's go out on some Goldberg variations, and I'll see you next time.
ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.
Bye.